From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Very bad day for former close associates of President Trump. His former attorney, Michael Cohen, pled guilty to illegal campaign activities, among other charges. Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, convicted of multiple counts of tax and banking fraud. The implications for the president right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's off to a great start. Coming up, dramatic changes affecting American brick-and-mortar businesses, from hardware to lingerie. And restaurants are contending with rapidly escalating operating costs. We'll look at the trends in our second hour. But first, the legal double whammy to hit former close associates of President Trump. As you just heard on NPR News, his former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, makes plea deal in which he admits, in the weeks prior to the election, funneling money to two women who'd claimed affairs with Trump. Also yesterday, the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was convicted on multiple counts of filing false tax returns, failing to report foreign bank accounts, and bank loan fraud. The charges related to millions earned from Ukrainian political consulting and from fraudulently obtaining bank loans when Manafort needed cash. With us to talk about these two cases and the significance is Jens David Olin, vice dean and professor at Cornell University School of Law. He joined us yesterday immediately after we got word of the conviction of Paul Manafort. Professor Olin, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
First, what is the significance of the Manafort case to the president versus the Cohen case? As a non-legal expert, it seems to me Manafort's kind of more the sideshow, but the Cohen thing has pretty direct significance for the president. But what's your legal view of this?
I think that's absolutely right. So the Cohen case is most significant for Trump personally. It's significant because most of the other cases that have been pursued by the Justice Department and by Mueller have focused on people in Trump's orbit. But Cohen's case now is the first one that touches Trump personally, because Cohen apparently is willing, he's already stated in court that he did this at the direction of a presidential candidate, which is obviously Donald Trump, and presumably he's willing to testify that that he did this at the direction of Trump and that Trump wanted this done in order to influence the election. When you combine that with the audio tapes that he's already provided to the prosecution, that seems to put Trump in a very serious legal position, not just for violating campaign finance laws, but also for a possible federal conspiracy charge. The Manafort case, I think, is also significant, but it's significant in a different way. I think it's significant because it very much bolsters Mueller's credibility and his investigation. They're doing serious work. They've uncovered serious allegations, and now they've proven it to a jury of his peers, and I think that's a good conclusion.
So even though it's not central to the mission of the Mueller investigation, this wasn't about Russian collusion. It was about Manafort's business and financial practices prior to running the Trump campaign. Even so, you think it shows the chops and efficacy of Mueller's actions?
Yeah, because regardless of who should be prosecuting and investigating Manafort, I think everyone has to agree that if you engage in this type of behavior, whether it's bank fraud or tax evasion, that's stuff that violates federal law, and someone should be prosecuting it. And if someone committed those crimes, they should be, punished under law. And so it certainly bolsters the idea that what Mueller is doing is not a rigged witch hunt. It's a serious prosecutorial effort.
I was a little surprised, again, as total amateur on this, that that Cohen pled guilty to campaign finance charges, because this here, the central allegation is, as the as the count reads, at the direction of a federally elected official, he pays money to the two women who alleged they'd had affairs with President Trump. It would seem to me that he could have put on a defense in court in which he said, you know, yes, I made the payments. Payments like this are made all the time by prominent individuals. This is, you know, part of what people who have the means to do it, if they're having extramarital affairs, do. Why would he make a plea that this was specifically to try and help the president's chances of being elected?
Well, yeah, I think there was evidence that this was done in with an eye towards influencing the campaign, in part because of the conversations that they had, but also the timing. I mean, the timing is just so suggestive. There wouldn't have been a need to do this at that particular time, but for the timing of the election. They wanted to make sure that the conversation was that it was shut down, that she wasn't able to publish these details or talk with the press in time for it to influence the election. And that's really, you're right, that's what makes it criminal. It's not illegal to reach a settlement with someone over allegations like this. But if they did it in order to influence the election, it becomes a campaign expenditure and it triggers all of the machinery of campaign finance regulations.
We're talking with Jens David Olien. He's the vice dean and professor at Cornell University School of Law. Also with us from the Institute for Constitutional Government at the Heritage Foundation. He's director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, John Malcolm. Sir, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So on this question of why Mr. Cohen would plead guilty to the campaign finance count here, why do you think he would do that instead of take this to court?
Well, so I agree with much of what Jens said. Before directly answering your question, I'd add one more thing about the Manafort case, which is not only is Mr. Manafort's troubles not over because he has at least one more trial scheduled less than a month from now in district court in D.C., but now that he has been convicted, the pressure on him to cooperate in order to get a favorable sentencing recommendation is that much higher, but whether he will or not remains to be seen. You know, I think with respect to Michael Cohen, it's a package deal. So, for instance, he may very well have been able to defend against this charge or that charge, but he wanted to wrap up all of his troubles at one time. So if the special counsel, or that wasn't actually the special counsel, it was the Southern District of New York, had him dead to rights on the tax evasion charges and on the bank fraud charges in terms of false statements to procure these loans, adding on this charge of campaign finance violations is not exactly going to do much to, you know, cause his sentence to go up. But it's certainly a charge that the Southern District and certainly Bob Mueller, I am sure, wanted to get because it now puts it within the orbit of activity that actually involves Donald Trump. So from, you know, Michael Cohen's perspective, so long as they've got solid evidence on some of these charges, it just makes sense to say, okay, I'll come in and try to cut off this bleeding as best I can. And he has, of course, provided whatever information he has to the special counsel. There's nothing in his plea agreement that specifically says that he will cooperate, but it does have a provision in there that he could get a departure from the guidelines if he provides substantial assistance, which by implication does involve cooperation. And his lawyer, Lanny Davis, has said that he is cooperating. There were a couple of things that interested me about the charge defense. It said that Cohen, when he made these payments, had conversations with one or more people involved in the Trump campaign. So we will see where this goes. Michael Cohen has at this point very little credibility, but who knows what other tapes. What? Documents are out there.
Well, and you just mentioned tapes. So I know this is just conjecture, but and I hear what you're saying about it's a package deal and he wouldn't necessarily think this would add to a sentence. But could this be a potential indication that in the recordings that were seized from Cohen's office and other locations, that there is direction from the president to pay this money specifically to avoid it coming out immediately before the election? And so that if they have a tape that says that would then lead Cohen, you know, they've got him dead to rights.
Yeah, no, who knows? So, I mean, these kinds of cases, these campaign finance violation cases of this type, are very hard to make. All you have to do is remember the case against John Edwards and payments that were made very close to the election by some of his contributors to Riley Hunter to keep silent the fact that they'd had an affair and an out-of-wedlock child. That case went to trial. It ended up being a hung jury. So proving whether this was to avoid a personal embarrassment or to actually advance an electoral effort, very fact-specific, very difficult to prove, and I wouldn't want to conjecture as to exactly what information by way of tapes or documents the special counsel might have. But obviously he felt he had enough to bring these charges, or I should say again, the Southern District, working with Mueller, thought they had enough to bring these charges, and Cohen admitted to the charges.
All right. Let's hear from Lanny Davis, the attorney for Michael Cohen. Yesterday, CNN interview in which Cohen had this to say about Cohen and possible comments to the Mueller investigative team.
I said, it's my observation that Mr. Cohen has knowledge that would be of interest to the special counsel about the issue of whether Donald Trump ahead of time knew about the hacking of emails, which is a computer crime that was the subject of the indictment of the 12 Russians. And we'll just have to see what Mr. Cohen is able to say from direct knowledge when and if he discusses this with the special counsel.
Let me bring into the conversation Loyola Law School professor and former federal prosecutor Lori Levinson. Professor, good to have you with us again. What do you hear in that comment from Mr. Davis?
I hear that at least Cohen thinks he has information that Mueller would be very interested in, because Mueller does have to make that tie. That is what Trump has been yelling about. He's saying nothing has to do with the Russians or the hacking of emails. Nothing ties me to that. And there's a tantalizing remark there that maybe in remarks that Trump may have made to Cohen, there is more direct information on that. We don't know, and I agree, there's a lot of speculation going on. But we do know that there was compelling evidence that was seized in those searches, both tapes and documents. And then it's up to Cohen to come forward with additional evidence, because the government doesn't need him, and they don't want him for things that they have on tape or in documents. That's more solid evidence. But if he can talk about other conversations and now they relate to the hacking, that's a whole new field.
All right. And as you look at the reason that Cohen would not take this to trial, what do you think are the reasons why he would make a plea deal like this instead of, defend against some of the charges?
Well, I don't want to make light of it, but he probably saw almost his life passing before his eyes in terms of the number of years he might spend in prison and miss being with his family and his children and otherwise. Even though he's facing right now, whether it's 4 to 5 years, that's time where people can come back and have more of their life. If he had gone to trial and been convicted on many of these fraud counts, the bank counts, the tax counts, he could have received substantially more time, especially because he's doing so in the role as a lawyer. So I think, frankly, it was just basic self-preservation or preservation of his family. If he wanted to have another stage to his life, whether it be professional or otherwise, it was time to cut the deal.
And why Lanny Davis going out yesterday and hitting all those different interviews? What is the potential benefit to Cohen in doing that?
I think the benefit is to try to create the new Cohen, which is to send the message to the prosecutors. He is valuable. You probably do want to weigh in with him. You want to give him some credit on reducing his sentence, but also to send the message to the public and to the president. I've decided which side I'm on, and I'm on the lawful side. And part of that might be to sort of say, there's the new Cohen. The prior Cohen was the person who was under the spell of the president. I'm not anymore. And Davis is saying my client isn't. He's independent, and if he's under anybody's spell, he's under mine.
And is the hiring of Lanny Davis part of that remaking, someone who was so closely associated with Bill Clinton and, you know, a very big Hillary Clinton supporter and Democratic supporter?
I think that's very much the case. I think it's sort of a message saying you no longer have this person and what he knows in the Trump camp.
We're talking with Lori Levinson, Loyola Law Professor, former federal prosecutor, John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation, and Jens David Olin, Cornell University Vice Dean and Law Professor. We're talking about yesterday's conviction of Paul Manafort on multiple counts and the plea agreement that the former attorney for the president, Michael Cohen, made on multiple counts, including the one getting the most attention, campaign finance criminal acts. Cohen admitting that at the behest of a federally elected candidate, he funneled money to two women who had claimed they'd had affairs with Donald Trump, and the timing of that and the significance of that directly tied in the charges to the campaign and the election. We'll continue with more with our legal scholars, and we'll also take a look at the political dimension to all this. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We return in 1 minute. If you have questions for our expert guests on the legal issues raised in yesterday's big courtroom news, or the political aspects of it, I welcome your calls. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You can put your thoughts broadly speaking on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, specifically for a call-in if you want to come on air. I'm really interested in questions that you might have about the legal or political dimensions of this, as opposed to just opining. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation, before I let you go, because I know you're off to make a speech, I just wanted to ask you here about, you know, sort of the difference between collusion and conspiracy, and what would have to be shown to show that the Trump campaign was conspiring with representatives of the Russian government. What's the threshold as you see it?
Well, everybody's been saying that collusion is not a crime. Collusion isn't a crime, but it doesn't matter. It's really a synonym for conspiracy, and conspiracy to violate federal law, including federal election laws, is a federal crime. In order to prove a conspiracy, you have to prove that two or more people had a meeting of the minds to engage in a violation of federal law, and that at least one of those conspirators took what is referred to as a substantial step towards committing that crime. So here, even if I don't know how he would know about it, but even if Donald Trump somehow knew that hacking activity was going on, and even if he somehow knew that hacking activity was going to be going on at some point in the future, if he did not agree to be part of that conspiracy and to help the conspiracy in some way, mere knowledge of an ongoing crime being committed by somebody else is not itself a crime. But of course, if you know he was involved in terms of saying, "Gee, I'd like you to break into, you know, the equivalent of Watergate, break into the DNC headquarters and grab all this stuff," then that would be a totally different kettle of fish.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us. John Malcolm, Vice President, Institute for Constitutional Government, directs the Heritage Foundation's Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. We appreciate it. I want to go back to Professor at Cornell University, Jens David Olin, and talk about the plea agreement and what the specifics are that Cohen has agreed to provide to the Mueller investigator or federal authorities about what he knows in exchange for that. How is this spelled out in any detail?
Well, right now, as far as I understand, there isn't a plea deal per se. He has pled guilty. He pleaded guilty to several counts, and he did so free and clear. And there's no formal arrangement. There's no so-called cooperation agreement yet with the prosecution that he'll receive a particular sentence. So in theory, he's pleaded guilty, and the court could sentence him to whatever the court feels is appropriate. And I think that the explanation for why there's no formal cooperation agreement with a quid pro quo, I'm wondering if the prosecution didn't want a formal agreement. There are certain times when the prosecution is holding a lot of cards. They'll refrain from actually doing a formal plea deal, and instead they'll ask the defendant to plead guilty free and clear, and then they'll seek cooperation informally from the defendant, and in return, the person will get some kind of consideration at sentencing. But they don't want a formal agreement because when that defendant ends up testifying at another trial against someone else, the defense attorney in that case will say, isn't it true that you're facing substantial prison time and the prosecution agreed to keep you out of prison in exchange for your testimony? And doesn't that give you an incentive to lie? And aren't you, in fact, lying today? And so that's the danger of these types of plea agreements. If, on the other hand, the defendant simply has pleaded guilty and he can truthfully answer, actually, the prosecution hasn't promised me anything. They haven't promised that they'll keep me out of prison. They haven't promised me anything in exchange for my testimony. I'm telling the truth. That's much more beneficial for the prosecution, and I wonder if that's what's going on here.
Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School, your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that that is accurate, although the defense lawyer will probably point out that by testifying that Cohen is hoping that he will get some break on his sentencing. So I'm not sure that it really gets the prosecutors out of the bind that they have an interested witness. I do think, however, both sides were eager to get this resolved. Timing is important. And by Cohen making his deal, it allows Mueller to move forward, other prosecutors to move forward, and the ball is in Cohen's court to show that he has something to help. They're almost sending the message, as was said, we're good. We are confident in our case, but of course you have the opportunity to help us even more.
Lanny Davis said yesterday in the interview that, or today I should say, earlier this morning, that Cohen would not accept a pardon from the president. Is that something you can just refuse to accept, a pardon?
It's an interesting question. I think you probably can, but I don't actually know the answer because I can't imagine.
It's probably never happened.
Taking that position.
Yeah, it's almost unimaginable because don't you usually sort of, that's a lobbying thing, you know, petitioning to get a pardon. So if it's just offered out of the blue, Jens David Olin, you ever heard of anybody turning down a pardon?
I have not. I think that there is an avenue by which you could turn down a pardon and petition the court and say, actually, you know, no, I'm not accepting sort of the expulsion of my criminal responsibility. But at this point, I think it's very unlikely that Trump is going to pardon Cohen. And I'll tell you why. The difference right now between Manafort and Cohen is that Manafort has stayed loyal and Cohen has not. And Manafort, I think, has not turned on Trump yet, and Trump wants to reward that, although the timing of a pardon for Manafort is very complex, and Trump could be accused of obstruction of justice again by pardoning Manafort. But with Cohen has not been loyal. He's broken from the president. Their relationship is irretrievably broken and fractured. And if Trump were to pardon Cohen, that doesn't prevent Cohen from still testifying against Trump. A pardon would remove your incentive if your reason for cooperating is because you want to escape criminal liability. But what happens if your reason for cooperating is simply because you want to tell the truth, or maybe because you don't like the person? Cohen, I think, is very angry at Trump. He feels like he devoted his life to Trump, and then Trump just sort of threw him away. And that's why I think the pardon no longer makes sense for Cohen, because Trump gives it to Cohen, and then Cohen still testifies against Trump. And what has Trump gotten in return? Nothing at all.
Yeah, and I can't recall if it was you or John making the point that he's in the reinvention process, and that wouldn't serve his interests if he is trying to change his image as to where his loyalties lie. Let me bring into the conversation from the Capital University School of Law in Columbus, Ohio, Bradley Smith. He's an expert on election and campaign finance law. He served on the Federal Election Commission for 6 years and chaired it back in 2004. Thank you so much, Professor Smith, for being with us. We appreciate it. On this issue of campaign finance criminal conduct, do you think that it was enough of a gray area that Cohen could have fought the allegation that the payments to the two women were designed to influence the election?
Yeah, I think he definitely could have. And I think, you know, Lori and Jens have already suggested, and John, reasons why he might not have chosen to do that, you know, that decided it was better to just plead guilty to those charges. But the prosecutors hang their hats on the broad definition of in the federal statute, which is anything intended to influence an election. But the courts have always wrestled with this because almost anything we say or do pertaining to public affairs might be viewed as ultimately intending to influence an election, and the courts have realized that's too broad a standard. And the question is, how do you cut it back? One way it's cut back is in the statute itself, which says that you cannot spend campaign funds for personal use, and personal use is any obligation that you would have had even if you weren't running for office. So note that it can include things that might benefit you running. Let's suppose, for example, that Trump had called his advisors in, maybe Michael Cohen, and said, hey, I've got all these lawsuits against Trump University, and I think they're a bunch of BS, but it's really messing up my campaign and looks bad. Settle those lawsuits. Would those have been campaign expenditures? And if so, would they have been payable then with campaign funds? In fact, would they have been required to be paid with campaign funds because they were campaign expenditures? You know, I think the answer to all of those questions is no, even though the purpose of making the expenditure would have been to benefit the campaign, and that would have been, you know, the hoped-for intent. So I think that's the part of the problem that the prosecutors have here and why it's been very hard to win this kind of case in the past. In other words, not everything that benefits a campaign is a campaign expenditure.
And is there any precedent for someone pleading guilty to or being convicted of using either personal or campaign funds in a way like this, you know, paying off to keep something from entering the public arena?
Well, I'm not familiar with something on directly the notion of paying, you know, blackmail or hush money or whatever. Perhaps the most similar would be one example that's been raised earlier, which would be payments made by individuals supportive of John Edwards to Riley Hunter in the hopes of kind of keeping that relationship secret. And, of course, there the prosecutors did bring charges, but he was acquitted of those particular campaign finance charges.
And were those campaign funds or from Edwards' personal money?
If I remember right, and here I have to say I'm going from memory, maybe one of the other guests knows, I think they were payments made by other people.
That sounds right, yeah.
Support her.
Yeah, good memory. All right. Jens, David, Olin, your response to Bradley Smith's analysis. Jens, you there?
Yeah, I'm there. I think that this is very much the current situation with Trump is very much on all fours with the John Edwards prosecution. And, I think that the John Edwards prosecution made a lot of sense because he was he had arranged for others to pay money to Riel Hunter because it would have been a disaster for his campaign if news of that affair and the child born out of wedlock had seeped into the public domain. So it seemed to me like a very strong legal case. Ultimately, the jury couldn't reach a decision on it, and a mistrial was declared. Of course, if there had been a conviction, then it could have gone on up on appeal, and there would have been a kind of legal resolution or a legal test of this theory. The Edwards prosecution unfortunately doesn't completely solve the legal controversy, but in my mind, if Trump decides that he has to spend this money or someone has to spend this money to keep Stormy Daniels from talking to the public, and the timing for me is really, really important. If he needs to do this before the campaign ends because the information is going to be disastrous for his political consequences, to me, that seems like an involvement in a campaign.
Jens, why do you think that in the plea deal, there's no mention of the president by name? What would be the reason for that?
I've been curious about that as well. It's possible that they don't want to taint the future of the investigation, and that they're anticipating that this is now an ongoing investigation, and they don't want to compromise the next step of the investigation, and so they want to keep the potential subjects or targets of the investigation confidential, even though it's an open secret. Everyone knows who it is, and it's interesting to see what the prosecutors view as the next step. Is the next step Trump himself? In which case, Trump can't be indicted, but the information could go into Mueller's report. Or is there a third individual who might be a member of the Trump organization who would be a party to this conspiracy, which is then not just two individuals, Cohen and Trump, but possibly three individuals, some, you know, staff officer within Trump Organization that was involved in dispersing money, and that the prosecution is then going to go after that individual, and that's the next phase of the prosecution.
All right. A lot of moving parts to this. I want to thank you all so much for your legal analysis. That's Jens David Olien, Cornell University, John Malcolm, the Heritage Foundation, Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson, and from the Capital University Law School, Columbus, Ohio, Bradley Smith, who served on the Federal Elections Commission and chaired it back in the early aughts. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll take a look at the political dimensions of yesterday's legal action, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the implications of yesterday's court action in the Paul Manafort conviction on multiple counts and the plea deal Michael Cohen, the former attorney for President Trump, made, including his admission that he violated campaign finance law by paying money to two women who had claimed they had affairs with Donald Trump. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPCC. Begin with Politico White House reporter Christopher Catalago. Thank you very much for being with us. First of all, what's the response on Capitol Hill to yesterday's events?
So we've seen a wide range of response. Obviously, it's been predictably partisan, but we've seen Senate Democrats really focusing on this idea that this guilty plea and the verdict in the Manafort case are reason enough for Republicans and, in particular, Donald Trump to allow the Mueller investigation to continue. They say that this is plenty of evidence out there and that they are really hoping to safeguard that investigation. We had some Democrats on the Hill talking about how this puts the president in legal jeopardy. And finally, we have folks kind of on the further left who say this really just reinforces their belief that should Democrats gain control of the House, that they really want to push impeachment. On the Republican side, this is not an easy thing to talk about. We saw Paul Ryan almost immediately after this plea and this verdict come out say that he needed more information, in particular to the Cohen plea. So it was sort of a dodge. We also see Republicans, they're a little bit mixed. Some of them say that this process does have to play out, the investigation. Others saying that they feel like President Trump is more in danger of being impeached. And then you see the Trump allies saying, hey, this is why we need to keep the Republican House, because using impeachment as sort of a rallying cry to turn out Republicans in November.
Well, and Chris, I wonder for Democrats, mainstream Democrats, they're considering the strategy of not saying much right now, just sort of this bad news for President Trump, letting it unfold at this point. There'll be plenty of time to pile on later, but kind of not get in the way of the bad news for the White House.
Yeah, there's kind of an old political maxim that when your opponent is in trouble, let them deal with it and don't get in the way. There's another more strategic reason why I think leadership and other Democrats are being a little bit more cautious about what they say. And I think the reason is if they come out and they say that there's not enough evidence out there yet for impeachment, and this is all there ends up being, depending on what's in the Mueller report, then they've sort of tied themselves. They're on the record saying that this is not enough. So they don't want to say that, but they also don't really want to play up, particularly leadership and Nancy Pelosi, this idea that impeachment is something imminent, because there is some thought out there that, this being a base election, not one where you're really going to persuade people, but one where you're going to have to motivate your folks to turn out, that this is something in the moment, at least the specter of impeachment, that may actually give an advantage to Republicans, because if they feel like this election, this midterm election coming up in November, is something that's nationalized, and you have folks across districts, I know in California, down in Orange County and in other areas, San Diego, if you were telling Republicans that they need to turn out to protect Donald Trump, to prevent impeachment, that might be a bigger motivator than for some candidate running for the House that some of these voters may not even know.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent point. Chris, thanks for taking a few minutes with us. I appreciate it. I know that Chuck Schumer said this morning he thinks the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings in the Judiciary Committee for after Labor Day should be delayed as a result of this. And I assume Republicans are not going to go for that. But thank you, Chris Catalogo, for being with us, White House reporter with Politico. Let me bring Matt Rodriguez into the conversation, Democratic strategist. Matt, good morning. What do you think is your party's best way to handle this right now?
Well, this is sort of a slow-moving train wreck here. I don't really know. There's not, and to be honest, there's not much Democrats really can do. To me, the Democrats can only hurt themselves with this. This is playing out. This is going to play out. I think there was a bad day yesterday for Trump, really bad. And there's nothing Democrats can really do other than to make this look even more political than it is and is going to continue to be. So I think Democrats need to step back, let the process play out. And at the end of the day, they should do it, I think, both politically. And there's a substantive reason for it. They're going to potentially need to sit in judgment. The House could potentially look at impeachment at some point. I don't want to get way ahead of the curve, and I've been trying not to push that. But the fact is, you have some responsibility to the voters and to the Constitution, and they should be stepping back and saying, we're going to let this process play out. And you can't sit there and say, we've wanted this process to play out for the last year, and then turn around because there's one conviction in court and turn around and say he should be impeached. So I think there'll be an effort by some mainstream Dems and more moderate Dems to keep the kind of Tom Steyer sort of, I don't want to call it lunatic fringe, but the lunatic fringe at bay. Because that's just sort of cheap political points. But I think they're going to try to be some adults in the room. We're going to say, let this play out and let's get to November and see what happens after that.
If in November Democrats take Congress, do you think there's any way they don't pursue impeachment?
Yeah, I do think there are. No, I think there is a way they don't. I think a lot is going to depend on what Mueller puts out there. I think at the end of the day, I don't think this Cohen thing is probably enough. I think there's probably more there. But I don't think right now, I think there's a lot we don't know. Most of these investigations, there are selective leaks in the media. You're not sure where they're coming from. A lot of times what you think you know, you really don't know. And I think we really have to get the Mueller report and see what that's going to look like. And so is there a scenario where nothing happens? I think if it's just something like this and a little bit more of this sort of gaudy and sort of ugly graft and corruption, no, I don't think that's probably enough to impeach him. And I even think Democrats will be concerned about that because I don't know if every presidential candidate running into 2020 is going to spend the entire time running against a trapped, Trump. Fighting impeachment. I don't know if they're going to want to push forward with that. That will remember that's going
that's
to be
a good
the
point. I hadn't
well.
Even thought how it would factor into the presidential election.
Yeah,
that way.
Which would completely dominate everything. It would dominate the entire. It may dominate it anyway, but it would be even worse. And then the idea of running against a president who I think would win his nomination. And running in the general election with Democrats, saying he should be impeached, it's going to put a ton of pressure on the nominee. So, no, I think there's a scenario where he's not impeached. And I think Democrats shouldn't say that this is a fait accompli. I don't think it is.
Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Sean, you concur this was a very bad day for the president yesterday?
Bad day.
And what do you think's the best strategy for Republicans to come out of this?
Well, there's a lot of Republicans that are terrified across the country. If you've looked at the primaries as they've rolled out over the past 8 weeks, you've seen almost every single candidate that President Trump has backed has actually ended up being the primary candidate that won the race, except for Freeze yesterday. So if you're a Republican, you're like, my God, if I step away from him, that could be the margin that costs me the election in November. And if I get too close to him, that could be the radioactivity that kills me in November. So they literally wake up every morning and, pick up their handheld devices and say, my God, what was tweeted out today or what happened today? It's just a lot of Republicans in very uncomfortable positions at this time.
Well, and if you were on the Democratic side, how would you advise?
Well, I think the Democrats have to be a little bit careful, and I think Matt talked about the lunatic fringe and the Tom Steyer fringe. There are some Democrat activist types that want to resist Trump at every move, protest at every event, throw eggs at him and his supporters, block every form of governance. And then there are those who want to impeach and impeach at all costs. And I think that the Democrats have some issues that they want to raise from a policy perspective, and you potentially drown it out by not by just allowing the impeachment debate to go forward. And then you can alienate some additional voters if it's a close election who are Democrats by saying you're not being tough enough on Trump on impeachment. So they've got a problem there, too, I think. Not as bad as the Republicans do at this juncture. But if you go all impeachment all the time, I think that will cost the Democrats potentially some support.
And Larry, I also whoever wants Trump to be impeached is voting. Those people who have been looking to be impeached him for a while are voting. I'm not sure the impeachment talk is going to move the suburban moms and some of the women that are moving away from Trump. I think Democrats need to let that part play out simply because it's not additive to you. It can only hurt you. And if something comes out where there's not a lot more, then it just looks like you're completely political. Just ask the Republicans how that played out when they impeached him in the 90s. They ended up losing seats in 1998. It looks blatantly political. That's a very risky strategy. And you always have to make sure with voters you're thinking about what their interests are. Because if that happens and they think that you're just completely playing politics, which that's what politicians do, but if it's too blatant, you run the risk of being in real trouble. And politicians putting their self-interest above what's in the interest of the voters can be risky.
When we continue, I want to talk a little bit more about the suburban voter. This has come up time and time again at that segment, particularly suburban women, being in play and retreating from the president. I want to explore that a little bit more. We're talking with Matt Rodriguez, Sean Walsh with us. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you have questions about the political dimensions of yesterday's legal action in the courtroom, it's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, the fate of a number of different sectors of brick and mortar businesses as they feel the heat from the big box retailers, as malls lose traffic. How are they competing? We'll talk about that. But right now, our focus on the two big court decisions. Yesterday, one, the jury returning the verdict in Paul Manafort's case, convicting him on multiple counts. The other, the plea deal that Michael Cohen, the former personal attorney to President Trump, the deal that he reached, including his guilty plea, that he used money to try and influence the election illegally by paying money to two women who claimed that they had had sexual relations with Donald Trump. With me are Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh as we talk about what the political dimension of this all is. Sean, I'm interested in the suburban voter. I think Matt and you have both brought this up on multiple occasions. The president really getting in trouble with suburban women, particularly who did vote for him in the last election. How central are they in the strategies of the two parties?
I think they're absolutely critical. I do think there was a lack of enthusiasm on Hillary Clinton's part for some of the suburban voters and even among suburban women voters. And I think there's a motivation now, the Pink Hat movement and other folks, to really go after President Trump and hit him pretty hard. And I also think counter, there are some Republicans that are very defensive, and they do actually hear the call of Donald Trump saying this is a witch hunt, and it motivates them to come out in larger numbers. The question is, you know, elections are decided by a very generally small swath of voters that may either not show up or swing the other way. And at this juncture, this is an acid effect that I think deteriorates people's willingness on those swing voters to support the president and also support Republicans who they perceive as being allies of the president. So I think the net effect on this is more negative towards Republicans, certainly, than they get the positive, groundswell of Republicans coming to defend the president or people associated with the party.
Is it, for Democrats, Matt, what do you think candidates and the party's going to have to do to appeal to suburban voters? So it's not just an anti-Trump vote.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it will be an anti-Trump vote. I mean, I think we've learned that over the last 10 to 12 years, that there's a lot of – you can go a long way by just being –
And you can get turnout just with an anti-vote?
I think Barack Obama had pretty much an anti – in 2010, it was a big Tea Party push. Same thing in 2014. I think what we've seen in the last 10 or – it even happened to Bush back in 2006. I think what we've seen is there's always a push by people on shows like this to say the Democrats, and it could be both sides, Republicans or Democrats, they don't have a strategy, they don't have a message, they have to talk about people's hopes and dreams. But at the end of the day, a lot of what our politics has basically been a very negative, grinding attack on the other side. And so the minute Obama got in, which was a very kind of uplifting campaign, by 2010, they were just saying, we're losing our country. It's this type of thing. In 2014, it was a very much of a negative. Healthcare is being, you know, we're socializing the government. And then on the Democratic side, it's like it's the end of the world. Trump represents authoritarianism. We're just one step away from being—
not so much hope being talked
Nazi
about.
Nazi Germany. Yeah, but it is really amazing how much we have come, how far we have come. If you listen to Barack Obama just 10 years ago, it is like, that's like another planet. I mean, that might as well be another century, that of the no red America, no blue America, if we work together, that is like completely basically gone. Basically, every 2 years, it's the other side is— it's the apocalypse, and if you do not vote for me. So I think the negative message is pretty much the way Democrats are going to go. They're talking about health care. They're talking about some of the things that they would do. But I think most of this is going to be a check on Donald Trump and a kind of out-of-control Republican Congress, the way they're going to portray it. And it's a challenge for Republicans because they are kind of like the dog that caught the car. They've talked for so long that everyone's against us, it's the media and this and that. Now they have all levers of government, and Trump is sort of dragging them down this rabbit hole.
If Kavanaugh's confirmed prior to the election, how big will that affect turnout?
My guess is not that much. People always talk about the court, and it never— – once in a while you have a Clarence Thomas or a Judge Bork type of thing that captures the nation's attention. But this seems— – unless something happens at the hearings that are coming up soon. Now, maybe something happens there that generates a great deal of interest or—
– usually everybody works hard to make sure nothing happens during
the— – well, and really since Bork and Thomas, a lot of that stuff has— – they vetted them differently, and they've also— – they basically give no answers. They just say, I can't answer any of these questions, and they do everything they can to kind of keep their heads low. So my guess is Kavanaugh is going to do the same thing. Now, look, something could come up or pop that we don't see. As of now, I think he's on a glide path to just get over the hump, and he'll be confirmed. Again, I think if you're really against Kavanaugh, I think Trump shouldn't get another justice. You probably already know where you're voting. I don't think, unless something happens, there's going to be a lot of energy around that.
Sean, the president already reacted with negative tweets about Michael Cohen. It sounds like he's still, you know, standing with Paul Manafort. What do you anticipate? You know, we're going to get a news briefing, the White House, coming up the next 20 minutes or so. What do you anticipate we're going to hear from those close to the president?
Well, here's my worry. I mean, you remember the movie Jaws? So you see this little fin off in the distance, and it gets closer and closer and bigger, and the Jaws music gets louder and louder. I think you're seeing a little bit of this Paul Manafort dynamic and the Cohen dynamic happening here. As noted by the gentleman from John Malcolm from Heritage, it was tried in the Southern District, so Mueller was smart and pushed that off to the Southern District and not part of his investigation. My issue is, and I also think that Bradley Smith was absolutely right, I don't think there's really any campaign problems in this case. The fact that the women wanted to talk happened to be the fact that they were— had more of an appeal getting closer to the campaign period. My worry is with Mr. Cohen, and people haven't really talked about this, and I'm surprised. Remember, there are the allegations that AT&T, their lobbyist folks, wanted to go through them so Cohen could provide access to the administration and the president. I don't know if Google or some other companies were involved in that whole issue too. So I think that's where the pay dirt is did Cohen influence the president, have conversations with the president or other members of their administration to have some sort of influence? Did Cohen actually have any communications or relationships with any companies that may have had any relations with the Ukrainians or the Russians? So I think Mueller has played this absolutely right. He's building his case brick by brick. The Jaws music is getting louder. And I think the implications now are the next trial really matters. President Trump is right. This was only about fraud and tax evasion. But this next trial is about oligarchs, where the money came in. Were any of these oligarchs actually financing or Trump properties a decade before that? So I just think this is, you know, we're on a perilous path. And he's got a great Mueller prosecutorial team, and they squeeze people, right? So they probably told Cohen, you're not going to see your kids for 60 years. So, you know, you go along with this, get an arrangement, and we'll see how it goes. Maybe get out in 3 to 6 years. So I just think, all right. And I've represented clients that have been under federal investigation and prosecution, and they are really going to put the vices on.
All right.
It's very effective.
Sean and Matt, thanks so much. Their talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later on the program, we'll talk about a novel idea for determining where a fire is starting and be able to send firefighting resources there sooner rather than later. We'll talk about the feasibility and the cost of an early fire detection system. But first, you know, we sort of joke when we book segments on Air Talk, we look for a pattern of three things sometimes to make it, okay, now we have a pattern. It's something that might make for a good segment. And just noticing things going on in brick and mortar businesses, which give us a good chance to check in on the challenges so many of them are having with online purchases, the decline of the American mall, and other factors that are going in. One is the news this morning that Orchard Supply Hardware, which has many Southern California locations, is going to be closing all of its hardware stores. Lowe's, the larger square footage hardware national chain, had owned Osh, had bought it out of bankruptcy. They announced they're going to close all the stores. The other is Victoria's Secret, which one of the biggest sellers of lingerie, underwear for women, is seeing a big decline in its sales. It's going through very tough times. And then I was looking at an interesting piece in the Los Angeles Times about how Cheesecake Factory and the restaurant business generally, because we think of it as, you know, so booming with a booming economy, that it's having challenges because of rising operating costs. Wages are going up. Rents are going up in many locations, putting the squeeze on restaurateurs who may find it hard to pass on a lot of their increased costs directly to the diner. With us to talk about some of the changes, retail reporter for Bloomberg, Lindsay Rupp. Lindsay, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's start with the case of Osh. Did they just get squeezed between the mom and pop hardware stores and the giants like Home Depot and Lowe's?
Well, so Lowe's actually has a new CEO. He came from Home Depot by way of JCPenney. And a lot of people see this as him just sort of taking some necessary cost-cutting measures to streamline Lowe's and position Lowe's better and really focus on Lowe's itself. I mean, Osh was just a very small brand for them, and they want to refocus on the core company because there is a big opportunity for retailers who are in that hardware home goods space. People are spending more on their home and on hardware, so he really wants to capitalize on that.
One of the things I thought was that Osh's niche was they could go into smaller spaces where, you know, some of the more urban areas, there isn't the footprint available to put in a Home Depot or a Lowe's, they could fit an Osh in. But it sounds like that wasn't enough of a niche.
No, and you know what? Lowe's is actually doing a little bit of that, too. They've got a couple stores here in Manhattan where I am. Home Depot's done the same. So I think all of these bigger box companies are really exploring different kinds of footprints and different kind of store formats because they realize sort of that, you know, we've got everything kind of format doesn't work in urban areas, and people want to live in urban areas. So I think, you know, for Osh, that may have been a differentiating factor for a while. But with this new CEO coming into Lowe's, it just isn't part of his playbook as a separate brand. You know, we could see him try different things with the Lowe's flagship, but I think he just really wants to focus on that.
Well, I was surprised as in New York a couple weeks ago, and one of those Lowe's you're talking about right near Lincoln Center, and I was surprised it just sort of tucks right in to the storefront there. You wouldn't know unless you saw the signage it was a Lowe's.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't carry necessarily the same kind of lumber and hardwood that your typical Lowe's would. But, you know, people in urban areas need tools and they need air conditioners and they sell, you know, they copy keys. So it's sort of a different, more specific offering. And you're seeing a lot of retailers do that, sort of localize their stores as much as they can, because they've realized people really want a specialized experience. If they're going to come to a store, they want to know that it's going to have what they're looking for, that it's going to be an easy experience, and that, you know, it's not just one size fits all.
Also with us is Marshall Cohen, chief retail analyst for the NPD Group, which provides analysis on the world of retail. Marshall, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So the restaurant business, you know, I've kind of thought it's a good time for restaurants. People have disposable income. We're looking at, you know, a boom of restaurants in Southern California. But I was reading that, you know, one of the big problems they're facing is this overhead expense going up. How significantly is that hitting some sectors of the restaurant biz?
Well, we certainly have seen lots of different things causing restaurants to feel the pain of higher wages, operating expenses, all kinds of even food expenses going up, the so-called tariffs in some cases might even be affecting some of the pricing. But the real key here is to recognize that in the restaurant business, 51% of meals now are consumed off-premise. That's a huge jump over the last few years. And what that means is they're losing some of the higher margin in some of the pickup additional items, whether it be the appetizers or particularly the bar bill. So when you look at the margin that the restaurants and the dollars that the restaurants are able to get, a lot of it is basically going out the door, whether it be somebody calling up to have it delivered or picking it up or curbside pickup. That's a big change in what's going on. That's going to cause the restaurant business to have to rethink their equation.
Well, and does the internet factor into this too, Marsha, because of the ease of using an app to order online or for delivery? Because, you know, I was mentioning about the effect of the internet on brick and mortar stores, but is that being seen in restaurants?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. As the restaurants begin to figure out how to utilize the internet, as well as other companies utilizing the internet to bring the restaurant to you, that's changing the dynamic for the restaurant business in a huge way. So absolutely, yes. Think of the younger generation, their willingness to buy a $5 hamburger and have it delivered and pay $5 for the delivery fee. So it's not just about value all the time. Sometimes it's about the convenience added in. Also think about just the ease of being able to have an app on your phone and order in the product, you know, the meal that you want, and done. So it's pretty different dynamic for restaurants as online starts to mature in this late to get into the online game restaurant business.
Well, and I'd never thought of it as you're describing people, therefore not getting a drink, not getting dessert, the sort of impulse buy that restaurants benefit from. That's not happening. And so how are restaurants then trying to create an in-person experience that's compelling enough so that people eat on site and buy that stuff?
Well, what they're doing is they're enhancing the services. They're enhancing the experience. They're enhancing the menu. You've got to realize that what's going on is that it's really all about the consumer trying to find more convenience. Look at what's happening. Even restaurants within entertainment centers, bowling alleys, movie theaters, things like that. There's all kinds of things that are going on that are creating a very different dynamic in the restaurant experience.
All right. Marshall Cohen, the NPD Group, joining us on Air Talk. And also with us is Gabriella Santanello, the owner and founder of A-Line Retail Consultancy based in Los Angeles. Gabriella, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So Victoria's Secret, which was, you know, such a big deal in the world of lingerie, their fashion show, which was, you know, highly rated event kind of programming thing. You know, what's going on with it? Is it a victim of the mall, demise of the mall, or something else?
I think it's twofold. Victoria's Secret has a CEO who really strongly believes in bricks and mortar. And today, that's just a very difficult thing to swallow. Every retailer is contracting. They're accommodating for online sales, in-app sales. And Victoria's Secret just isn't doing that. No one needs 1,000-plus stores today, especially with what we're seeing with online. But that said, there's still about 80% of all retail sales comes from bricks and mortar. And I would think that recent earnings reports indicate that mall traffic is, in fact, increasing. It's not where it was 5 years, ten years ago, but it is increasing. And what we're seeing at Victoria's Secret is I think they have an image problem. They're all about the angels. The angels are unrelatable. The stores look like an outdated boudoir. Their main competition is Aerie, which is an American Eagle Outfitters company. Aerie is all about body positivity, inclusivity, acceptance, and Victoria's Secret is exactly the opposite of that. So what they're seeing is the customers are just pushing back. They don't like the messaging. They don't identify with them as a retailer, and so consequently they're not shopping.
Is this a case you think where a company like that can recognize what you're describing and remake itself in a way that connects more to today's shoppers, or is that difficult to do when it's been so successful in the past building an image that's fallen out of favor?
Well, it would be a long road. It's definitely difficult to do, but you have to start somewhere. What we saw a couple of years ago when the bralette trend was taking off, Victoria's Secret had kind of missed, missed the boat on that. And then they had a whole ad campaign. It was all you, no padding, and they had it in the windows and all the advertising. And they had the advertising for about a month, and then immediately they reverted back to the angels. So I think it lacks some authenticity, so the customer doesn't necessarily believe them. So if they're going to do it, they really need to do it wholeheartedly. They're running a promotion right now where if you bring in an old bra, you get $10 off the purchase of a new bra. And they put together a whole YouTube campaign, and they're highlighting their bra fitting that service that they offer in store. But they're fitting angels, and so the reactions are quite funny because customers are saying, oh, okay, so the angels don't really have that cleavage when they're actually wearing the bra that's the right size. So that, too, lacks some authenticity. So I think they really need to go back to the drawing board and come up with a better plan.
How does this happen with a company that, you know, has the money for market research, can constantly get feedback from, you know, very targeted gender and age specific audience? How does it get in a place like this and not realize it's got to make significant changes?
I think they can be in that situation. It starts from the top down and their CEO. He's been a CEO for a long time. He's in his 80s. He's a majority shareholder of the company. So he still controls a lot of what goes on at Victoria's Secret. So, you know, there might be something internally going on there that they're sort of unable to take that step forward. But I do think eventually they will get there, just hopefully.
All right. Gabriella Santinello is the owner of A-Line Retail Consultancy based in Los Angeles. Marshall Cohen of the NPD Group, let me go back to you and get back to Osh, Orchard Supply Hardware, closing all of its stores, a big closure like this. Where does that leave the hardware business and how much of it, you know, stays a brick and mortar business and how much of this is shifting online? Marshall, you there? No? Okay. Let me go back to you, Lindsay Rupp of Bloomberg. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that there are some things that we're probably not going to see shift online. You know, I'm thinking about the people who work in construction who go to a hardware store in person so that they can, you know, buy lumber and buy supplies they need that day. So contractors probably still want to go to brick and mortar. But you know, everyone needs to have a robust online presence to be able to compete. And like Gabriella was saying earlier, I think everyone is scaling back their physical footprint because, you know, we are a country that has too many stores. That's widely accepted. So it's sort of that finding that sweet spot for you, right, where you have enough stores so that they're conveniently located to the people who need them and the customers who want to come in to shop them, but not so many that it's a drag on your business.
And what's going on with wages? Because, you know, there's been such stagnation in wages. Minimum wages in many places hadn't been raised. We're starting to see some movement on wages. Are retailers equipped to deal with that?
That's a really big problem for retailers and restaurants, especially, actually, is, you know, wage increases, because we're in a really tight labor market, and retailers and restaurants are competing really hard for talent because they need to have good people in their stores and in their restaurants. And they are often, especially restaurants, working with really tight margins. And when pay goes up, or benefits, you know, those are rising too. That was a big problem with Obamacare. A lot of retailers and restaurants were complaining about that added cost of having to pay benefits. And, you know, that's a huge squeeze, a huge cost on these retailers and restaurants. At the same time, the argument goes that if you raise those wages, then, you know, those people are going to be able to spend more money in the economy, in theory, be able to spend more money at your stores, your restaurants. And so it's a virtuous circle. So as of right now, it seems like it's been a pain point, especially you brought up Cheesecake Factory earlier. It's been a real thing that they've called out recently.
Marshall Cohen, NPD Group, I know you're back with us. Your thoughts on wages and how that factors into retail and restaurants?
What ends up happening is, when you think about the dynamic, the number of people that work in a restaurant don't nearly match up to the number of people that dine in a restaurant. So even with higher wages, you don't necessarily see the automatic parity that would normally occur. So that's one thing. The other thing is, what we're seeing is a consumer, even with higher income, is spending across a much more diversified range of product. And some of these products are extremely expensive in some cases. So if you think about technology and you think about some of these other businesses, it's really about recognizing that consumer dynamics are shifting. Even with wage increases, it's good for the economy, but it doesn't necessarily bode well for every industry.
All right. I want to thank you all for being with us. Oh, we have a call. Monique in Fullerton, you're on Air Talk. You want to weigh in on the financial troubles of Victoria's Secret.
Hi. Yeah, I was telling the person we spoke with earlier that I spend about $500 a month there, and I think the returns are too hard. You have to pay to return stuff. You have to pay to ship stuff. The environment in the store is too crowded, so if you want to do a return, you're going to be there for 20, 30 minutes in line. I actually was at the West Side, Victoria's Secret when they were closing, and they were talking about employee theft, like, right in front of me. They tend to be pretty young, so they aren't really that great at customer service yet. And their credit card company that they use is pretty unprofessional. So it's just overall.
And yet you still spend $500 a month at Victoria's Secret. Wow.
The fit and the style.
Okay. So you like the clothes. You're willing to endure the other stuff. Monique, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Monique in Fullerton. Again, thanks to Lindsay Rupp, Marshall Cohen, and Gabriella Santinello for joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, we're going to take a look at a proposed way of spotting fires when they're very, very small and could be responded to much more quickly, perhaps keep them from turning into a huge conflagration. We'll talk about the technology proposed in 1 minute. Coming up later this hour, the farewell to college students. Parents are going through the experience, in many cases, of seeing an empty nest or at least one less of the flock at home. And for young people, it can be an emotional challenge as well, going off to college. We'll talk about that whole drop-off experience, what it's like, and hear your stories. If you have particularly memorable experience when you went off to college or when your child left the nest, that's coming up in a little bit on Air Talk. Right now, our focus is on technology that might allow firefighters to much earlier spot a fire that could spread into something bigger. Joining us is astrophysicist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at UC Berkeley, Carl Pennypacker. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
It's an honor to be here, Larry. Thanks for including me.
So let's start, first of all, the detection part of this. Describe for us the system that might enable fires to be spotted when they start, let's say, by a lightning strike in the middle of nowhere. How could we detect that sooner?
Well, actually, the lightning strikes in the middle of nowhere are not nearly as serious as the wildland fires right, you know, next to Pasadena. But we now have the capability from many altitudes, from a fire tower, you know, 50 feet to drones flying at 8,000 feet or 80,000 feet up to satellites flying in geosynchronous orbits at 25,000 feet. We can all these systems can be fused together to give us a really clear picture of what the fire is doing. And then coupled with models of fire propagation, we can know whether we want to let this one burn or really throw all of our assets at it. So, you know, we just entered this amazing age of sensors, of computation, of telecommunications. And I think we now have the ability to supplement, you know, our brave women and men of CAL FIRE and Forest Service. I mean, these people just, you know, risk their lives daily, you know, suffer like crazy, do a great job. But I think we have the ability to help them out. I think that's what we want to do. I mean, you know, I've worked most of my career looking at little bright spots in galaxies a billion light years away. And so we're quite good at spotting small fires or measuring existing fires. Let me add one thing. Even measuring fires frequently can save lives and property. We, for example, the Santa Rosa fires, I guess the Tubbs fire, it kind of exploded and came roaring into the Coffee Park neighborhood nobody knew that was happening, and the evacuation orders were not issued, and it was, you know, I think 44 people died in that. We, you know, with continuous surveillance, which is we have ready to go with, if within a month we could do this irregularly, continuous surveillance, we could have watched the fire, saw that it was moving very fast at, you know, tens of miles per hour.
And explain how this would work. So let's say you've got a satellite over the United States and actively monitoring that, would there be certain you'd have algorithms that would lead you to be able to spot something that might be a fire, and then you'd zoom in on that, or how would it work?
Yeah, it'd be easy. You know, differences are much easier to see in fires than you know, something static that's not changing. So we use well-known algorithms that can see differences, watch a point grow, and then we'd watch to see if it's growing, and that would let us know and discriminate against false alarms. So that, I think it's clear we have capabilities both in software and the sensor networks to be able to do this. There are some existing Department of Defense satellites out there that were in discussion with. So that, I think, you know, there's some stuff take 5 years to implement. Some stuff we can do right now. But it's really, I you know, the fact we're attracting the interest of good people like you, I think tells me society's going to change within a year or so.
We're talking with Carl Pennypacker, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at UC Berkeley, astrophysicist. Also with us, Deputy Director of Communications for California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, known as CAL FIRE, Mike Moeller. How helpful might this kind of technology be for CAL FIRE, Mr. Moeller?
Absolutely, and thank you again for having us and let us explain the importance of this type of technology. Not only CAL FIRE, but our federal partners in the Forest Service and local government continue to look at real-time monitoring, but also those early detection systems. You know, the importance of initial response to a wildland fire and keeping that under 10 acres, as you had mentioned earlier, is, you know, seconds can make the difference between what we consider initial attack fire and keeping it under 10 acres to one of these mega fires like we've seen with the Mendocino complex, the Carr fire. So as we move forward and technology becomes available, again, not only CAL FIRE, but all fire agencies are looking at the different opportunities and technologies out there for early fire detection.
All right. I need to break because we have a live from the White House press briefing with Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
On Air Force One saying he knew nothing about these payments, when in fact we now know he knew everything about these payments. So has he lied?
Look, again, I think that's a ridiculous accusation. The president in this matter has done nothing wrong, and there are no charges against him. John?
The president said to Fox News in an interview with Ainsley Earhart this morning that this could not have been an illegal campaign contribution because he paid the money. He put more than $60 million of his own money into the campaign, so how do you draw the line between, I mean, maybe this didn't flow through the campaign, but how do you draw the line between what was a campaign contribution and what might have been a payment to somebody for other purposes.
Look, I'm not going to get into the back and forth of the legal part of this. I would refer you to the president's outside counsel on that. As I told Cecilia, what I can tell you is what the president has stated a number of times. He did nothing wrong. There are no charges against him. Just because Michael Cohen has made a deal doesn't mean anything with regards to the president.
Stephen. Sarah, the president tweeted this morning in frustration that Michael Cohen wrote. Perhaps you can shed a little bit more light on that, because the implication is that that Michael Cohen gave up something that the president would rather stay secret. Is that what we should read into this, or is there another?
The president has expressed his views on that. I don't have anything further to add.
Can I ask one other question? Is the president now planning on or intent on pardoning Paul Manafort?
The Manafort case doesn't have anything to do with the president. Doesn't have anything to do with his campaign. It doesn't have anything to do with the White House.
I actually was going to ask about Manafort, but let me ask in a slightly different way. Even if it has nothing to do with the president, he still could have the power to pardon Mr. Manafort. Is that something that he's begun discussing with the team? Has he ruled it out? Does it come up? And
I'm not aware of any conversations regarding that.
We apparently just lost our feed with the White House, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, with the White House press briefing there. As you heard, a number of questions. I think we've got the feedback up.
It's not that there are that many times like this. White House is often trying to figure out whether there need to be any internal adjustments to deal with some of the political issues you're going to have now with the Hill, with voters, with internally with lawmakers. Is the White House making any adjustments in terms of responsibilities of chiefs of staff, of communications to donors, communications to supporters, how you intend to kind of respond both protectively and offensively to the crisis that you're now in?
I wouldn't view it that way at all, and would disagree with the premise of your question. The White House is focused on the same things that we were focused on the first day that we got here, and that is growing the economy, which is doing extremely well, protecting our borders, strengthening the safety and security of all Americans. Those are the things that we're focused on day one, January 20th, and those are the same things that we're focused on right now. Jake?
Thank you, Sarah. First, I'd like to start off by congratulating you. This is your 100th briefing, and there's no way this, what you do every day, is easy. I've got two real quick questions. First of all, our colleague Jonathan Swan over at Axios recently wrote, and I quote, "Several top Republican operatives working on the midterm elections told me Trump's fanciful red wave predictions could depress Republican turnout and ironically serve to make any blue wave even bigger." So are you familiar with any Republican operatives who would concur with this statement?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that the thing that's going to encourage people is the lack of a message by Democrats. They have nothing to run on other than attacking this president. And not only does the president and the record that Republicans have had over the last year and a half under his leadership is a great one to run on. We have an incredible story to tell. The economy is booming. Record numbers just today. We're going to continue focusing on the things that Americans care about. And I think that'll be certainly what encourages them and certainly what will help push Republicans to do well in November.
Listening to live news conference, the White House briefing conducted by Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You heard the questions there about yesterday's guilty plea, the deal that was made by former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, as well as the conviction of Paul Manafort, former campaign manager, multiple counts there, including bank loan fraud, concealing foreign accounts, as well as false tax returns. So we heard from Ms. Huckabee Sanders, the president denies any wrongdoing and doesn't see any connection to Paul Manafort's conviction with him. So no word about any possible pardon for Mr. Manafort or for Michael Cohen. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we're going to talk about how you deal with your child going off to college, what that experience was like for you, one end of that or the other, how you coped with that. And if you're going through that this week or you did last week with your child, child going off to college. Love to hear about how you've dealt with that and whether you were surprised by your emotional response to that event of your young person leaving home. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy's. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Once again, I welcome your calls about the experience of your child going off to college. What surprised you about the way you responded to it? What did you learn about yourself as a part of that? And are you going through the experience right now? We're at 866-893-KPECC. And while we await your call, we continue our conversation about the Fire Urgency Estimator in Geosynchronous Orbit System. The system known as FUEGO would provide geosynchronous satellites, aerial drones, piloted aircraft, and fire towers to build an array that would be able to detect fires when they start and keep them from spreading and, of course, ultimately getting close to inhabited areas. Carl Pennypacker, astrophysicist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at UC Berkeley, leads the team of researchers that's developing this system. Also with us from Cal Fire, Mike Moeller, the Deputy Director of Communications. Mike, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there for the White House press briefing, but are there holes in the current monitoring system that something like the FUEGO system might help?
I don't know if there's holes in the system. Is there room for improvement? Absolutely, as these technologies become available to us. You know, an example is what we call the HP Wren system in San Diego with a series of cameras that are monitored by 911 centers where we can actually see the fire when it's in its infancy. But I wouldn't say holes, but is there room for improvement with these new technologies? Of course.
Well, and the example Mr. Pennypacker gave about the fire that, you know, came out of Napa Valley, swept down the hills into that Santa Rosa neighborhood so fast that there wasn't even time for evacuation orders. Is that something where an earlier detection system could have been tied to a warning system, and that there, you know, that could have, if not been, you know, stopped earlier, at least that there would have been more notice?
No, sure, absolutely. If and again, we look at the Santa Rosa fires. You know, that we had a wind event there called the Mountain Wave Wind. Yes, early detection and alerting can help in getting the public out of harm's way. But when you see extreme fire behavior and wind conditions like that, even though we may have monitored it in its infancy and made out alerts, that fire, unfortunately, with those conditions was going to be explosive. But seconds count, as you well know, in any type of emergency emergency situation, including wildland fires.
Let me go back to Carl Pennypacker at UC Berkeley. The kind of thing where you can couple micro weather patterns like wind events and how recently an area has burned, could all of this essentially be put into a database where you could come up with an almost instantaneous forecast of the danger of a small fire?
Well, not quite instantaneous, but pretty quick. In as much, I mean, it runs on supercomputers, and sometimes they take, you know, minutes, maybe even hours to turn around a prediction. But for example, these programs use the fuel data, the terrain data, the wind data, you know, everything conceivable goes into these computer programs. And then actually what's missing, in fact, is getting what the fire is doing right now and then predicting from that. We can't even tell the computer program where to start, what the initial conditions are. So the computer modelists, and there are a half a dozen excellent groups, you know, several in California and you know, Colorado and Johns Hopkins. What we'd want to do is provide them with much more precise measurements of where the fire is at that time. And then they have all the fuels data, the slope data, the wind data. That's you know, they'll have a pretty good matter, the moisture data. They'll have a pretty good idea of then how to predict where the fire is going to go. That'll be useful too. And these actually is very, very encouraging. These programs are based on our weather weather calculation systems, and they take into account fire-produced winds, which is a scary thing, like the fire tornado at the car fire, this kind of tornado produced by the fire winds. They can start to get a handle on that, which is also, you know, a very important first-order effect from the fire storms.
Carl, what about the cost of this? If you're talking about a dedicated satellite and an array like you're describing, how much is that likely to cost?
Well, I mean, you know, we would use existing infrastructure largely. We need some tune-ups, et cetera. But, you know, this might sound high, but probably for $1 million, we could get this whole thing churning along. I mean, but $1 million, when you have a $2 billion fire, we're at, under a tenth of a percent of the cost of that. So if we can even trim the fire cost by $100 million, we're getting a huge return on our investment.
So are you talking about using existing satellites to be able to do this monitoring? You wouldn't need a dedicated one?
Well, our hope would we could bootstrap off of some existing satellites, and discussions are going on. The Department of Defense is justifiably concerned about, if this data, these are for the defense of our nation, and they don't want any perceived adversary to know what we can detect. So there's a careful dialogue in process with these groups, and we want to go very carefully with the DoD satellite.
All right,
but We've gotten encouragement from, in fact, some groups on this. So I think I'm optimistic about that. Eventually, we'd probably want our own satellite because we're looking at slightly different things than DOD is looking at. But that, nobody would spend probably the $60 million it would cost for our own satellite without proof of concept. And I think that's actually true at all altitudes. We have to prove to CAL FIRE that we're really making great measurements. I think firefighters can be justifiably skeptical about what we can do because we haven't, not being done on a regular basis yet.
Yeah, you'd have to demonstrate the viability and utility of the information. Also with us, Jessica Gardetto of the National Interagency Fire Center, which is based in Boise. It's the focal point for coordinating national mobilization for firefighting resources. Ms. Gardetto, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what sorts of surveillance do you have currently available to be able to monitor and determine, when fires are small, whether they're a particularly high degree of threat?
So currently, we rely on several different methods. Number one being witnesses. Most human-caused fires are reported by people because they're started in populated areas. So amazingly enough, people calling in wildfires, they call, just the emergency 911 number. That is a really high rate of fire detection. And then we also have our dispatchers watching lightning maps. We can tell where we think lightning is going to strike and when it does strike. So that's a way to determine lightning-caused fires. And then, as I believe Mike with CAL FIRE mentioned, there are also cameras. If you look at Nevada, for example, they have fire detection cameras set up throughout the state that so far have proved to be useful as far as detecting fires. And then the U.S. Forest Service still even employs some lookout towers. Obviously, they're not as widely used as they were in the past, but they're still effective as far as identifying fires, and they're cost effective too.
What about drones? Are they a part of this?
Yes, they also use drones, but drones can be tricky because, you basically have to have a drone out patrolling, looking for fires. But that is another technology that we're using, and of course, not just for fire detection, for all things fire management related.
Well, and I would just think you could potentially, if you're talking about rugged terrain, you could get a drone there maybe faster than a helicopter or, certainly get ground firefighters there.
Exactly. And we're already using drones for even things like prescribed burning. So you could fly a drone up there and drop ping pong balls that allow us to back burn without even putting firefighters in some of these areas. So, and this is this technology is just another thing that we're looking at in that's the thing about federal agencies is they are always looking for new technology that can help the wildland fire situation. You know, looking at California and all the horrible fires they've had and the homes they've lost, we're always looking for new and helpful resources.
All right. Jessica Gardetto with us, the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. Mike Moeller of CAL FIRE with us. Carl Pennypacker, who leads this research team at UC Berkeley's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He's an astrophysicist. We're talking with him about this array, which would include satellite imagery. It would include drones, sensors, infrared cameras, all to be able to provide a much quicker, more accurate feedback on when a fire is starting and enable resources to be deployed more quickly to fight the fire. That's the hope. Again, coming up on Air Talk, I'd love to hear from you. The challenge, dropping your child off or seeing your child go off to college. I'm going to go through that experience with our son Desmond in a year. But I've got colleagues who are talking about the experience, how emotional it is, and even some surprises in how parents are responding to that. So I'd like to hear your story, something that maybe points out what this was like, this milestone in your and your child's life. Or if you remember well that experience of going off to college, you might have been surprised by your feelings about that. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. Many thousands of teenagers each year head off to their first year of college. And for parents, that can be a very difficult time, although in some households, perhaps jubilation, that if it's the last child out of the house, maybe it's mom and dad have the house back to themselves and are celebrating that. In other cases, it's a painful separation. I'd like to hear from you. How that experience was like for you. Going to go through it the first and only time next year as our son goes into his senior year of high school. And so we have plenty of time to prepare for that. But I've been fascinated hearing some of my colleagues' experiences. John Horn's older son just getting dropped off by John and Linda at his university as he starts. John still has a younger son who's at home. But I wonder if it changes from child to child and depends on the distance. Maybe if you have a child going out of the country to go to college, for example, is that maybe a different experience? And if you have a particularly poignant memory of from when you went off to college and how you felt about it, maybe surprised yourself or your parents did, we're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Glenn in Manhattan Beach, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, my daughter, I'm in Manhattan Beach, obviously. She went to Villanova, so 3,000 miles east. This was last year. Extremely emotional. They have it very regimented. You move your kids in on Friday. Saturday, you have a picnic, and the parents are all told you're off campus at 7 o'clock at that moment. And, you know, you have about, I don't know, 2,000 freshmen, so there's about 4,000 parents staggering off the campus in an emotional state. But so it was time to say goodbye to our daughter. I've been an emotional wreck all week long. My wife, who's less emotional, broke down at that moment, and our daughter commented on that. And it was really, it was a moving moment. But we got back to the hotel, and we go to the bar because we're just a wreck emotionally. And we, you know, had got ourselves calm by that point. And the bartender comes up with a big smile and says, "How you guys doing?" And we start crying. And she's like, "Oh, no, another Villanova."
I was going to say, he knew right away what you were crying about, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's a milestone moment. And, you know, now a year later, she's adjusted. She's doing great. But it really is a moment that just is going to tug at every parent's heartstrings.
Now, do you have any other kids or just the daughter?
We've got another one who's coming up in another year, so we'll go through it. might be a little more prepared for it this time, but it was moving. But, you know, she's going to Spain this year on an exchange moment.
Nice.
In Spain for 4 months, and I'll be meeting her in the middle of December when she gets back from that, and we have family there. So, you know.
Sounds good. You're adjusting. Glenn, I appreciate it. Glenn in Manhattan Beach, a wonderful anecdote to start off, dropping their daughter off at Villanova on the East Coast. Dan, in West Los Angeles, now you've had two kids you've sent to college. Was there a difference?
Yeah, so we have three, actually three, but
okay.
Our oldest we sent to Wisconsin, out of state, which had its own our own feelings and experience on that. Our middle one is at USC, so that kept it a little local. That was a different experience, and then of course we got a senior in high school
who's coming up,
going through the process again.
Yeah. Well, how different was it from the Wisconsin drop off from the SC?
Way different. You quickly, once you drop them off and you head back to LA, talking about Wisconsin, you just realize very quickly you're thousands of miles away, and you feel the difference. And these colleges and universities, you know, when you check your kid in, they make it a very, very fun and engaging experience for the parents, and so they make it very festive, and it's a celebration. You know, you're celebrating your kids' achievements and so forth, and then come Sunday night, they say goodbye, and
party's over.
That's when you start to feel it, yeah.
I'll bet. Hey, Dan, thank you so much. Let me share some more listener comments. Rick in Westchester said, 10 years ago, we took our second child to school, driving home from San Diego. We practically couldn't go home. We were crying so hard, Rick said. We had to pull over a lot on the way back, but we're fine in a few weeks. But the empty home, that was sad. That was tough. Rick, thank you. Jim in Palm Springs said, I'm the youngest of four, so by the time my parents dropped me off, it was no big deal. My mom gave me a quick hug and they left. It was more emotional for me than it was for them. I'll bet, Jim. Yeah, so they'd gone through it before. They were all steeled for it, but not for you. Barbara in Santa Monica, that I was a single mom. I dropped off my second child at college. And Barbara says, I recommend doing it with someone else, even your ex. It's just so emotional to have, you know, someone else there is very helpful. Mary in Long Beach, real quickly, your experience.
Hi. I had a daughter that has graduated now. We went to Hawaii in school, and the amount of independence she gained over those 4 years was amazing. Just wanted to point out, too, I have a daughter with special needs who's going into her sophomore year of high school, and it really is a privilege to have a child that can go off and be independent. I don't know that my daughter will ever have the skills to go to school away from home, so that's one thing to keep in mind. Also, I was an elementary school teacher for 15 years, and we would have the kindergarten parents clinging to their kids, not wanting to leave them. And it was the same kind of thing where it's shut the door and send the parents on their way. There's a lot of helicopter parenting going on, and, you know, it's the best thing for the little kids to get their independence and the best thing for the college kids as well.
All right. Hey, Mary, just quickly, as a teacher, do you go through something at all similar when you come to the end of the school year and you know those kids are moving on?
Yeah, but, you know, luckily I always taught the lower grades and I would still see them.
You'd see them. They'd still be at the school.
Yeah.
Hey, Mary, thank you so much. That's Mary in Long Beach. You can share your comments about the parting that can be sorrowful when your child goes off to college, or in some cases, though we didn't hear that today, maybe celebratory that you get the house to yourself. Thank you so much for joining us. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Terry talks with Andre Holland, very busy actor, starring in the new Stephen King-inspired series Castle Rock. He played the adult Kevin in Moonlight, the Oscar-winning Best Picture, and played Andrew Young in the film Selma. Now playing Othello in London. So that whole experience, very, very busy man, with Terry Gross coming up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10. From all of us at AirTalk, have a great day.